Good morning. I'm Mark Reilly here on Air America Radio. It's 6 past the hour, and you're listening to Morning Sedition. Hi, kids. It's Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Reilly. It's the last day of Mark Maron's vacation, ladies and gentlemen. He will be back on Monday. So all you bloggers, conspiracy theorists, and paranoiacs, rest easy. The man will be back. We got a very special guest co-host with us in studio, political cartoonist extraordinaire, Mr. Ted Rall. Good morning.
Good morning, Mark.
Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you.
I really appreciate you being with us, and I really appreciate anyone that can draw, because I can't draw a stick figure. I am the most klutzy human being when it comes to drawing. And, you know, your work has been both controversial and cutting edge as far as cartooning is concerned. And you've also kind of stretched that out into political commentary. I mean, you're not just a cartoonist. Sometimes I feel bad when I...
Just a cartoonist.
Well, what
do you mean just a cartoonist?
I mean, you're not... You have other skills. You're a multitasker. You're multi-talented. Triple threat, that sort of thing.
Yes. Well, you know, I'm incompetent at three different jobs, which add up to one living. That's the way I look at it. You know, it's a cool job, and I do think that, you know, it's kind of funny that what you said about, you know, not being able to draw.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people would say the same thing about me, but I think everyone can draw, really. It's just a function of practice.
Really?
Yeah, I really think that. It's like, you know how everyone says they can't sing,
mm-hmm.
You know, and in college, I had an ethnomusicologist who sort of proved to us that in every culture, wherever recorded music first starts, it kills singing. And then, like, within, like, 10 years, everyone in the society says, yeah, I don't know how to sing, because they hear professionals, and they're like, I don't know how to sing. But everyone knows how to sing. Kids know how to sing. I mean, everyone can draw. Every kid draws.
Yeah, I guess. But I'm not a kid. I'm in rough shape. But your most recent book is called Wake Up, You're a Liberal, How We Can Take Back America from the Right. I guess you must have been really depressed after the election, huh?
Yes. I was. Like every thinking person. I think the worst part about it is the lack of rage. I mean, you know, you have and I guess also the worst part about it for me was the fact that really the Democrats did as good a job as they know how to do, and it didn't work. You know, there was great turnout. The party was united. Nobody voted for Ralph Nader. They were united, and it just wasn't good enough.
Wow, that's a crushing thing when your best just isn't good enough.
Yeah, I thought that was rough. I mean, and you know, we can look at all the corruption in Ohio, but it should have never been close. You know, I think
I agree
that they did throw the election, but it still should never have been like this.
Did the election change the thrust of your work at all?
The 04?
Yeah.
Yeah, it did. It's interesting because between 01 and 04, a lot of my work was dedicated towards trying to convince my readers that Bush really needed to go in a way that not just because he was a Republican or a conservative, but because he was something special, an illegitimate president, someone who'd stolen power, someone who had dictatorial tendencies, someone who was dangerous, someone who was trying to transform the United States into a different kind of country than what we grew up in. And after the election, I realized, look, Bush isn't, you know, unless he sees his power, is not going to be around in 08, right? So there's no, you know, 09. So we have he's kind of done in a way. Whatever wars he starts are already sort of predetermined. And I just got tired of the Bush bashing that I'd done myself. So I still do it, but I've been moving more towards sort of more humorous commentary and trying to focus on social commentary stuff. I mean, you know, like the Terry Schiavo case is great,
man.
Right, exposing the hypocrisy of the party and the way people think, you know, people being who are pro-war and pro-death penalty being pro-life at the same time is obviously hypocritical. And you know, it's more fun and more interesting to make those kinds of points than just, you know, Bush is evil, which is true.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, it remains true. It'll be true until 09, as a matter of fact.
But, absolutely.
Yeah, I just sometimes, Ted, I swear to God, I just don't know what kind of country we've let ourselves in for after this election. Because we see little by little, sometimes with baby steps, sometimes with Terry Schiavo, people trying to flex their muscles and, you know, not just change things for themselves, but change things for everybody else, even for people who don't want to see them change these things.
It is an attempt to hijack what we're about. You know, politics is always, I think, the process of trying to decide what kind of country we want to be, right? It's that argument. And then if whoever wins the argument gets to pass a law. But it's gone so far now that, I have friends who think that the president doesn't really decide anything, right? The corporations decide things. But I think a president can set a tone. You know, Clinton didn't really get much done, but he sort of set a tone for that, you know, people needed to be left alone, that, you know, government was going to be out of our lives. So ironic, because it's not what anybody thinks. And now you have exactly the opposite. You know, you have a guy like Bush and his cabal. They embolden all the jerks among us. You know, I mean, there's a tribalism in our society that no one talks about, right? It's like the war between the mean and the nice and the smart and the dumb.
Mm-hmm.
And the mean and the dumb, who usually have to sit around and shut up, are now like, wow, our guys are in charge, and now we get to lord it over the smart and the nice.
Wow. You know, I never thought of it that way, but I think you're absolutely right. I think what's seeming to go on here is that people are trying to recast the country in an image that I don't think really ever existed, in fact. But this is what they think America used to be about. Or they get political capital out of, you know, convincing other people this is what America used to be all about. And we're going to take it back to 1956. We're going to take it back to the days when everything was cut and dried and real simple and they didn't have porn in hotel rooms. You know, I mean, that kind of logic.
It's a fake history, though. It's a fake 1956, right?
Yeah.
When black people were in the back of the bus.
Exactly.
And poverty was even more widespread than it is today. And there was just so much even more injustice than there is now. It's sort of like, well, everything went wrong when you took God out of the schools.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing.
Really? I remember before God. You know, I remember when God was in the schools. I had school prayer.
Me too.
And they beat me up every day during recess. It was not, you know, these were not, the fact that Christianity was part of the public school system somehow didn't mean that Christian ideals or morals were actually being practiced in the school system.
Absolutely not. And the Pledge of Allegiance didn't make anyone more patriotic back then either. I mean, it was all part of I guess, some people's way to convince themselves that their view of society is the most valid view of society.
Yeah, well, it's people who aren't willing to do the heavy lifting of actually finding out what's going on and reading books and reading the paper, but they want to get the same credit as the rest of us who do, and then they want to tell us what to do. I mean, it makes them feel, you know, it's easier to buy into a set of 10 cliches like that thing about the schools or the Pledge of Allegiance or whatever, than it is to actually be an informed citizen.
Absolutely. Now, ladies and gentlemen, in the most serendipitous bit of casting since I've been on this network, in fact, through most of my career in broadcasting, we have with us today Ted Rall, who is one of the experts on what's going on in Kyrgyzstan?
Oh, come on. We did this before. Kyrgyzstan.
Kyrgyzstan. I'm sorry. Yes. Lord have mercy. Kyrgyzstan. A place that's many, many miles away. It's in Central Asia. Most people don't know what it is, and they're probably saying, so, well, why aren't they discussing the Michael Jackson trial? Because actually, what's going on in Kyrgyzstan is, to me, a lot more interesting. And it does have some pretty strong implications for this country and for the rest of the globe.
Absolutely.
It's
a huge story.
Yeah, it is a very, very big story. And we're going to tell you why it's a very big story. We're going to tell you why you need to care about what's going on in Central Asia when we come back. Ted Rall is our special guest co-host. This is Air America Radio.
Hello, this is Mick Foley, professional wrestler and best-selling author, and you're listening to the two guys who give the right wing the smackdown. It's Mark Maron and Mark Riley with Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. This is Morning Sedition. Good morning. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is back on Monday. Our special guest co-host is cartoonist Mr. Ted Rall. And by the way, cartoonist and Kyrgyzstan expert.
That's,
you've been
that's
there.
Right.
Now, let me tell you what happened yesterday, folks. We're on a conference call Jonathan Larson, our producer, you know, the usual suspects. Ted gets on the line, and we start talking about Kyrgyzstan, and Ted says, well, I've been there. And we think he's telling a joke, so we all break out laughing. Kyrgyzstan, yeah, Ted, you're kidding, right? No, I've been there.
Seven times.
Seven times. That's how many times we laugh before we finally believe that you had actually been. But this is amazing. And again, this is some really serendipitous. I appreciate that you're, you know, gonna let people know about this, because it's one of those things. Most people can't find Kyrgyzstan on a map, if, you know, if they look hard. I went, after I started seeing, you know, stories on TV, I actually went, we have a world map downstairs. I actually looked it up, found out where it was. This is one of the 15 former Soviet republics. It is the Central Asian component of those 15 former Soviet republics, a nation of about 5 million people. But Ted, take it from there, because that's all I know.
Well, you're absolutely correct. And it's a country that's not important in and of itself, but it's surrounded by a lot of places that are very important. Kyrgyzstan only has one major city, the capital of Bishkek, a lot of mountains. And it was known as the Switzerland of Central Asia after 1991. It's like all the other breakaway Stan republics like Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan. Kyrgyzstan was thrown out of the Soviet Union. It's not one of those countries that was chafing for under the yoke of communism. They were getting subsidized from Moscow. And the Russians, when they became independent in December 1991, said, guys, we can't afford you anymore. You got to go. We got to cut you loose. So Kyrgyzstan, like all these other republics, just became whatever they had, whatever was left lying around became Kyrgyzstan. You know, the Aeroflot planes became Kyrgyz Air. The army became, the Russian troops that were left behind became the Kyrgyz army. And so they had to reinvent themselves from scratch. And unfortunately, they have no natural resources whatsoever. They're landlocked. They were hoping for tourism to rescue them, but that didn't really work. They have, you know, the Uzbeks and the Turkmen have tons of natural gas. The Kazakhs are sitting on top of the world's largest untapped oil reserves on Earth.
Wow.
They have 260 billion barrels of oil right next door. The Saudis only have 40 or 45. So the Kazakhs are poised to become the world's wealthiest nation. If they can ever get their oil out to sea. And that's why this is what's going on in Kyrgyzstan is geopolitically really important, because it's making the dictators of all these other republics very nervous. And what you've got to understand is the irony of this is that Askar Akayev, the deposed president of Kyrgyzstan, was by any objective standard the most liberal and most beloved ruler of any Central Asian republic.
Now, they ran him out yesterday.
They ran him out.
Violent street protests. People were seizing buildings. He has vanished from view. It doesn't appear yet that there are reports about exactly where he's wound up.
My money's on Uzbekistan or Kazakhstan.
Really?
Yeah, the neighbors will take him in.
They will. So he's going to be seeking asylum. Now, he is one of the only or one of the few democratically elected heads of state in the region and of the former Soviet republics as well.
That's right. You have dictators like Islam Karimov of Uzbekistan or Nursultan Nazarbayev in Kazakhstan and the notorious Turkmenbashi, Saparmurat Niyazov in Turkmenistan, who has his picture everywhere. Those guys were all in the Soviet dictators of the SSR, those various SSRs before 1991. But Kyrgyzstan was very liberal. Akayev came to power democratically. He was a former physicist, very popular in his country. Unfortunately, the country's economy imploded after 1998 when the IMF withdrew their funding. And when the economy headed south, he decided to go more towards the authoritarian route wallowed in some corruption. But still, by Central Asian standards, Kyrgyzstan was paradise.
Now, was he moving from liberalism to autocracy? I mean, I saw him described yesterday on BBC News, of all places, as becoming increasingly autocratic. How did that manifest itself?
Well, you'd see there was an increased police presence, and I think most visibly...
But unarmed police.
Yeah, unarmed police. It was, like I said, it was the Switzerland of Central Asia. The police, but really it was the parliamentary elections that were manipulated by, and I think, you know, he met with the other dictators in the region. Mm-hmm. And I know that they were telling him, like, guy, you know, you've got so much instability in your country. You've just got to control things a little tighter. So he had the key figures from his government who had become his political opponents after throwing them out during the 90s, some of whom were in jail, who was forced to let out. You just sort of saw, you know, I mean, honestly, in comparison, he was, I guess the difference between Akayev in 1996 and Akayev in 2005 is maybe the difference between Clinton and Bush.
Really?
Yeah. It's
all rolled up in the same guy?
No, I wouldn't go quite that far. But in terms of a tendency towards autocracy, I mean, it's not fair to say that the United States has become an autocracy. But certainly you see autocratic tendencies. You know, we have concentration camps. It didn't go that far in Kyrgyzstan. But he was cracking down.
Now, Kyrgyzstan is about 75% Muslim.
That's right. But it's a secular state.
It is a secular
state. They drink vodka. There's discos. Women don't wear the veil.
But now, will it stay a secular state after Akayev's ouster at this point?
Well, I think there's one of two ways this can go. I mean, the current opposition movement is dominated by people who are not terribly popular or charismatic and who are essentially former Kyrgyz KGB officials and that sort of character. Can any of these guys pull the country together? I doubt it. Kyrgyzstan is ethnically diverse. The Kyrgyz who are in Kyrgyzstan are only about 60% of the population. There's Tajiks who are a huge percentage of the population.
Really? Okay.
And the southern part of the country is very conservative. Where this insurgency began in the city of Osh is the capital of the Fergana Valley, which is a big hotbed of Islamism. So this could go either direction. The state could remain secular with the same old personalities from the 90s. Or it could definitely go the route of Islamism.
So much like the United States, the conservatives are in the South.
That's exactly right. Living in very remote, boring areas without good culture.
Oh, my goodness. So we're going to talk when we come back a little bit more about Kyrgyzstan and a little bit about the implications, because there is a U.S. presence there.
Yeah.
And we have to talk about that and what the implications of this change, which is, by the way, the third former Soviet republic to see its government fall in the past year and a half. What is this going to mean for the United States? Right now, Condoleezza Rice is calling for calm. I don't know exactly what the hell that means, but that's the extent to which, I guess maybe they're all stuck on the Shiloh case or something, but they've been kind of quiet. We'll talk about that and a whole lot more. We got a POW pilot coming up as well when we continue here on Air America Radio.
Morning Tradition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Four past the hour. Good morning. This is Morning Tradition on Air America Radio. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is back on Monday. Our special guest co-host, Kyrgyzstan expert and political cartoonist, Mr. Ted Raw. We're going to talk more about Kyrgyzstan momentarily. But first, Kent the Colonel Jones has arrived with the day's POM pilot. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning, Mark. Good morning, Ted. How are you?
Good morning.
Good.
All right. Vice President Dick Cheney is on the road supporting Bush's Social Security plan. So here we have Dick Cheney's POM pilot. 7 a.m., wake up. Curse the weak, forgiving dawn. 9 a.m., prepare to speak to citizens about Bush's Social Security plan. Note, remember to shift mode from Dark Lord Shakhtar, blood-smeared demon spawn to regular guy Dick, concerned elder statesman. 11 a.m., tell conservatives that I am absolutely, positively not running for president in 2008. Probably. Let's see how long I can make these weasels beg.
Okay.
1 p.m. Stand behind Bush's decision to keep ignoring the Minnesota school shooting. Note, this is clearly a stunt by the Democrats to keep us from repealing the assault weapons ban. 2 p.m. Tell reporters that the nomination of John Bolton to be ambassador to the United Nations shows President Bush's commitment to multilateralism. Note, this sounds better than the UN can go bleep themselves. 4 p.m. When answering questions about the Middle East, repeat that, quote, up until now, diplomacy has been a very weak part of our arsenal. Note, eat that, Colin Powell. I killed you, and now I will gnaw on your bones.
Oh, my.
9 p.m. Welcome the night. Savor the darkness.
Nice work, Colonel.
Thank you very much. See you later.
All right. We're talking Kyrgyzstan with our guest, Mr. Ted Raw, and we're talking about America's interests in this Central Asian Republic, where the opposition has ousted President Askar Akayev, and he's been there for, what, 15 years almost? Since 91, huh?
That's right, yeah.
Incredible. Now, first of all, there is a U.S. military base in this country.
That's right, along with a lot of military bases that sprung up in Central Asia after 9-11. There's one in Uzbekistan, and one in Kazakhstan, and one in Tajikistan. Well, there's two of them in Kyrgyzstan. One's sort of well-known. It's called Manas Base, Air Base, outside. It's just the airport outside of Bishkek. And there's also a secret CIA base near Tokmak, which is
secret,
sort of an open secret.
You know about it, but it's secret.
Well, you know, obscurity creates secrecy. There's no need to hide anything when there's no reporter assigned to Bishkek from any major news organization.
You mean there's no CNN bureau in Bishkek?
Shockingly.
Oh, wow.
It's not the highest priority.
Now, what was it? The parliamentary elections were the problem as far as, I guess, the people that led this revolt that ousted Akayev. What is the future for them now? I mean, we talked before the break about the possibility of this country sliding into some Islamic fundamentalist type state. I get from you, Ted, that you're not so sure that specific scenario will happen.
No, I think it can go either way. As we were saying before, there is a huge Islamic influence in the southern part of the country. There's a group called the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, which is, to make things super confusing, based largely in Tajikistan and trained in Afghanistan by the Taliban. This is like a limerick.
All stand radio. Yeah.
Yeah, all stands all the time. And but these guys really have had very limited success in trying to overthrow the government of Uzbekistan. So they operate in remote rural areas in Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan. Southern Kyrgyzstan and southern Tajikistan are both kind of failed states outside of the central control of any government. And these guys are operating in very conservative areas, and they do want to restore a very radical brand of Islam and the caliphate and all that great Osama stuff that we all know about. At the same time, the opposition figures who led this revolt are largely figures from the cabinet, from Akayev's cabinet, who were thrown out ostensibly for corruption in 96 and 98 and 2000, some of them have been sitting in prison, some of them not, in the sort of time-honored post-Soviet tradition. And those guys could seize power. That seems like the most obvious route, but I wouldn't be at all. But you have to remember that the popular support for this movement comes from the South. And you can be sure that the people in Bishkek, the general population, is looking with a sort of horror at these people from south of the mountains coming, crossing the mountains down from the south, from Osh, and taking over their very metropolitan capital with discotheques and bars and Italian restaurants. It is a transitional time for them.
Now, let's look at, when we look at what happened in the Ukraine, we saw a dynamic where there was one person that was more aligned with the Soviet Union, and then one person that was aligned with the West. The guy who was aligned with the West was the one that won out in the end after they had the second election. Is there that dynamic here? Is the opposition here looking to establish closer ties with Putin and Russia, or is that just a moot point as far as Kyrgyzstan is concerned?
Neglect really characterizes Russia and the United States' approach towards Kyrgyzstan. And the main thing is that during the 90s, the United States and Russia both sort of were fighting this new kind of great game over Central Asia as new oil and natural gas strikes were discovered. But they quickly discovered that Kyrgyzstan only has rocks. So they decided
gas, rocks.
You know, so it's great for landscapers, but you know, you're not going to really be able to do much with that. So the U.S. and Russia has really had very little interest at all, and there's no Russian-aligned groups really within Kyrgyzstan. That's different in some of the other Soviet republics. Tajikistan's very close to Russia.
Okay.
But the U.S. influence there has been limited to essentially to, hey, let us have our base so that we can essentially establish our influence. Chalmers Johnson wrote a great book that came out last year called The Sorrows of Empire, and he talks about this huge post-9/11 military infrastructure that we've built in areas that used to be Soviet-dominated, and the bases in Bishkek and southern Kyrgyzstan are part of that. But what we're really interested in here is not Kyrgyzstan. What we're really interested in here is Kazakhstan and their huge untapped natural gas and oil reserves.
200-something billion?
260 billion barrels of proven reserves.
And here in America,
according to the U.S. Energy Department,
the Congress, you know, has to pass a law so they can try and get at $10 billion in the Arctic Natural Wildlife Reserve. That's incredible.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, parenthetically, I think the ANWR thing is clearly just symbolic. It's about we want to be able to mess with the environment whenever we want. It's not about oil. If it was about oil, we'd be working on the Kazakhs.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, if it was about oil, what we would do is cut a deal with Iran and build the short route for the Kazakh oil and natural gas pipeline to the Persian Gulf.
Yeah.
And control and dominate that facility and collect the transit fees, and we would... The U.S. would be set for another 400 years of oil supplies.
Well, that's as long as I'm going to be here, that's for sure. You know, when we talk about this region, we've seen situations in the past, Ted, where there have been democratically elected governments, there have been questions about whether or not these kinds of changes of power will produce some charismatic strongman who will come back and end up running the country, the elections, the parliament, later for all of that.
Yeah.
Is there such a charismatic strongman in Kyrgyzstan?
Absolutely not. There's no one like that in Kyrgyzstan. Kyrgyzstani politics, the Kyrgyz are very relatively mellow people, and they don't really buy into the sort of tribal cult that you see in neighboring Turkmenistan with Saparmurat Niyazov, he's notorious. He's worse than Saddam. He has his face on all the money, his face on all the stamps. He's got posters of himself all over the country, and in the capital of Ashgabat, he built a gilt statue of himself several hundred meters high that turns as the day progresses to face the sun.
Wow.
And the joke in Ashgabat is that the sun actually turns to face him.
Oh, God.
Now, that's the neighborhood that the Kyrgyz live in, and they're really renowned as not buying into this sort of thing. And they're not really big fans of autocracy. I mean, Akayev, by local standards, you have to categorize it that way. By local standards, was not like this. You know, the cops in Kyrgyzstan don't carry guns. You don't get stopped at checkpoints. That's just not the lay of the land in Uzbekistan, where you get stopped every 10 kilometers and shaken down for 2 hours for money by cops who are armed to the teeth. Cops board the buses carrying AK-47s and banging the butts into your head while they check the guy across the aisle. I mean, you know, those are frightening places. And Kyrgyzstan just was never like that, which is ironically exactly why this revolution was able to take place.
Incredible. Well, we're going to talk a bit about some other places where America has an interest, and other places, obviously, where they have military bases. Donald Rumsfeld was in Brazil this week. He's gone to South America, and we're going to tell you why Rummy, our defense secretary, was talking with Brazil's defense people, and about why and who America is trying to destabilize in South America. Now, they're keeping their hands off of Kyrgyzstan, but that doesn't mean that they don't want to put their fingers in pies where they feel it necessary. We're going to talk about that and a whole lot more. When we come back, our special guest co-host is cartoonist Ted Rawl. This is Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition.
Just wake up.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about those people.
On Air America Radio.
Thanks.
49 minutes past the hour. This is Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is back with you on Monday. Back with me on Monday. Right now, we've got Ted Raw, political cartoonist extraordinaire, with us. And we've been talking a bit about Kyrgyzstan. And now we're going to switch gears and talk about another area, hotbed, actually, of activity. Donald Rumsfeld, U.S. Secretary of Defense, was in Brazil this week. Now, a lot of folks, this is, by the way, the same Brazil where George W. Bush said, hey, you got black people down here? I didn't know that. News to me. Anyway, that was a while ago, and I guess he's learned since then. But Rummy was in Brazil, not so much about issues pertaining to Brazil or even to the region. He's got one thing on his mind, one person on his mind.
Oh, yeah.
Hugo Chavez of Venezuela. He's upset that apparently Chavez has ordered 100,000 AK-47s from the Russians. He's wondering what they would use them for. Now, Venezuela has a military of about 100,000 people. That would seem to me to say each one of them is going to get a gun. But, you know, Rummy, I guess, had to go down to Brazil. He seems very upset by this, and it is escalating, Ted, a war of words between America and Brazil that's gone on for a long time. Ever since America, through several different organizations, backed the coup against Chavez in 2002, there was a guy that was on television, Spanish television in Miami not too long ago, who said that the CIA was prepared to assassinate Chavez. Said this, and this is a former CIA guy, anti-Castro Cuban. Incredible stuff.
It is incredible. Again, it's always about oil. That's the connection.
Yeah.
Right? It's always about that.
It's always about oil. And you know, the Venezuelan oil monopoly actually has some, makes some good money right here in the States. They've benefited from the run-up in oil prices. Why? Because they own all the Citgo stations here.
And they are our largest, they are the largest exporter of oil within the Western Hemisphere to the United States.
Absolutely. That's why I buy my oil from Hugo. I buy my gas from them, too. Anyway, this situation is one that we cannot afford to ignore because we could see some Chile-style intervention again in South America. You know, Rumsfeld is not down there for laughs. He's not down there because he likes feijoada in Brazil. He's down there because he and the Bush people are very upset, not just about Venezuela, but about what appears to be a series of elections where left-leaning people have become heads of government down there. Uruguay, Chile, Argentina doesn't have a guy with a uniform running the country anymore.
Right.
And there's a leftist, apparently, who's preparing to challenge Vicente Fox in Mexico next year.
Yeah, the mayor of Mexico City.
The mayor of Mexico City. I don't know how he could win, though, with all that pollution. Anyway, that's a whole other story. But the question then becomes, what happens if there is a left-leaning government on America's doorstep? And they don't want to see that happen. Now, obviously, they can't intervene. And, of course, the only right-wing government left in South America, or so it seems, is Colombia and Uribe, who are an elected guy, so you can't argue that democracy has not run its course there. But how interesting how America promotes democracy around the world but is prepared to destabilize a democratically elected president in an oil-rich state.
Well, let's face it. The Bush administration really got their Bush they got their Bush kicked in a big way by Hugo Chavez. You know, Social Security is really the second big failure of the Bush administration, and Hugo Chavez humiliated them. I mean, you know, he literally walked away from that coup. The people put him back into power, and it just made Bush look stupid at a time when he was riding high.
And you know, then they turn around and say, well, there's going to be a referendum on whether Chavez should stay in power. And, you know, the American media and certainly the White House were saying in the run-up to this recall election in Venezuela, he's going to lose. He's going to lose big. I guess there's stooges down there told him. And, you know, they said that he would lose by a 58-42 margin, and he won by a 58-42 margin.
Well, maybe they were. It's just like the Gore Bush thing. They just sort of got it backwards.
Yeah, exactly. And now, since that didn't work, since the referendum didn't work, since the coup didn't work, Rummy goes down to Brazil and acts like you can't buy AK-47s on the streets of the United States.
Yeah, I was wondering if he's just being pissed off because the United States didn't get to sell those arms to Venezuela instead.
But, yeah. They're also he's also upset because they're buying helicopters. They're buying helicopters from a Brazilian company, in fact. And there are questions that Rumsfeld seems to have about that. This is going to be, I mean, after this whole Middle East thing is settled, if it ever settled, if the Iraq War ever ends, if all of these situations chill out, the bottom line is South America is going to heat up right behind it. Right behind it.
No doubt about it.
And I think at a point, you know, we have to be able, as progressive people, to say that we support, you know, because these are not radicals. These are folks that this is not the shining path taking power.
No, these guys are closer to what Tony Blair started out as.
Yeah, you know, they're reformers. They want, and Chavez, from what I've read, you know, in the independent press, because you will never read any of this in mainstream media, but from what I understand, he has used the windfall that Venezuela's received from the run-up in the price of oil. He has poured money into the poorest areas of Caracas and some of the other large cities. And, of course, South America is looking at the United States now that Paul Wolfowitz has been nominated to head the World Bank. And they're saying, what are you doing here? What is going on here? How are you going to resolve this? How are you going to have Paul Wolfowitz running an organization that is dedicated to alleviating poverty when Paul Wolfowitz's worldview is that Hugo Chavez ought to be 6 feet under someplace sleeping with the fishes?
Yeah, the United States just doesn't have much of a leg to stand on as an alleged promoter of democracy. And, you know, this is nothing new, really. It goes way back. You know, I think of Fidel Castro's first move upon seizing power was to attempt to establish full diplomatic relations with the United States. And he was snubbed by the Eisenhower administration. And, you know, Ho Chi Minh had American flags at his 1945 or 46 when he had the Viet Minh inauguration for himself.
Did you know that Ho Chi Minh went to Columbia?
Yeah, I know that. Big fan of the United States.
And used to work at a Chinese restaurant in Harlem. I found this out when I first started working in radio.
That's cool.
Because the Chinese restaurant was still open. And this guy came to me and said, did you know Ho Chi Minh used to work over there?
What did he do? Was he a chef?
He was a chef. They had these huge pots, and he was like a regular cook. He used this money to go to school here at Columbia. It was walking distance. It was just, the place was on Lenox Avenue on 125th Street, right in the heart of Harlem.
But it's gone now.
Yeah, it's gone now. Actually, Sylvia's restaurant, the famed soul food restaurant, took over that space. But I'm old enough to remember when it was still a Chinese restaurant. And they would talk like, Ho used to work.
I wonder if he was a good worker.
I imagine he was. He managed to get back home. But be that as it may, we see America's long arm moving throughout the world. And, you know, it is going to be up to progressives. It's going to be up to people with a different worldview to say, whoa, you're going too far. Americans have said, whoa, you're going too far as Terry Schiavo's, because that's too many fars in one sentence, but what the hell.
Far, 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 far.
Yeah, right. People believe that the government's gone too far in the Terry Schiavo case, specifically the Congress. We're going to give you all the late developments in the Schiavo case, and we're going to talk a little bit about some of the implications of it as well. When we come back, here on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Good morning. It's 6 minutes past the hour. This is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. My name is Mark Reilly. Mark Maron is on the last day of his vacation. And you better be on time Monday, Maron, because I know you're listening out in L.A. Our special guest co-host is none other than political cartoonist extraordinaire and troublemaker extraordinaire, Mr. Ted Rawl. Good morning, Ted.
Good morning to you, Mark.
Now, you did make a little trouble, didn't you?
A couple times.
Tell us about them. We love troublemakers here on Morning Sedition.
Well, troublemaking comes with the job when you're an editorial cartoonist. But since 9/11, I did a couple of cartoons. One about Pat Tillman, the ranger who was killed in Afghanistan. Another one about the 9/11 widows called Terror Widows.
Whoops.
And then there was the fire department one. I shouldn't forget that one about the fire department in the year 2011 when they're getting so much money in donations that they have to burn the money to
you're a hard man.
So it was it's satire, you know, it's what people are talking about, and you have to focus on it and do commentary. But you know, these you know, the right wing isn't big on humor. And,
no.
And left wing humor is especially bad when you're a right wing.
I guess Dennis Miller is all they got, huh?
Yeah, he's not funny anymore, though.
I know. Now, I'm assuming you must have been really happy that the fire department's been ordered here in New York to actually release all of the transcripts and tapes of the time leading up to the September 11th terror attacks.
Well, yeah, and not in a gleeful way. I think I'm against secrecy, as really any American should be. As a patriot, you should be against any kind of secrecy from a government agency. You pay these people's taxes. Why are they keeping things secret from you? I still want to hear the cockpit voice recorder from United Flight 93 that went down in Pennsylvania on 9/11. There's a lot of stuff that we need to hear and to find out what went wrong and what could be done better. And, you know, anytime they're keeping something secret from you, there's a good reason. So I am glad.
Yeah, yeah. Now, later this morning, we're going to have with us the Reverend Barry Lynn. Those of you who listen to Morning's Edition regularly know that name because he's the executive director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State. And he'll tell us how he got a hold of that little secret tape of Tom DeLay, House Majority Leader from Texas, talking about Terri Schiavo, which is what we're about to do. There have been a number of developments over the last 24 hours. The United States Supreme Court is not hearing the case. Judge Greer, the judge in Florida, said that he was not going to intervene. He was he rejected a petition on the part of the family, the Schindler family. I'm making the same mistake mainstream media does. They say the family, and they really only mean the Schindler family.
That's right.
You know, her parents. They wrote when they say
not
the family
that can decide anything under Florida law.
Yeah, exactly. So everybody's kind of taking their hands off of this, at least as far as the judiciary is concerned. And it looks like, Ted, they're starting to lose a little bit of support from members of Congress. As people are kind of like throwing up their hands and saying, gee, there's not a whole heck of a lot else we can do here.
Well, there's the law. And, you know, you can really see the grandstanding at work when you think about the lay of the land in Florida, right? I mean, they've got a Republican governor, a Republican state house. If they wanted to change the law down in Florida to allow the parents to have these sort of to make these sort of decisions, they could. The only problem is that the state that would be unpopular with the state of Florida,
yeah,
even among conservatives. I mean, what about sanctity of marriage? What about, you know, everyone understands that once you get married in this country, your spouse becomes your next of kin.
Yeah.
Everyone knows that. It's not your parents anymore. It's like, oh, but, you know, the parents have to be able, can't let go of their little girl. Their parents were supposed to let go of their little girl when they walked her down the aisle.
Yeah. And, I mean, she's been in this state for 15 years. And it is only now that we see all of this hand-wringing on the part of politicians. Now, the family, the Schindlers, are apparently trying one last tack here. Late yesterday, they went back to court, federal court, to Judge James D. Whitmore in Tampa, and they went with an amended lawsuit charging that the removal of the feeding tube was a violation of Terri Schiavo's constitutional right to live. Now, Judge Whitmore said he would rule on that sometime today. That would seem to be the last judicial avenue that's open to the family. There was talk at a point yesterday, and this was kind of where I thought this was going to go, and I was kind of getting a little nervous about it. There was talk that Governor Jeb Bush of Florida would actually ignore these court rulings and try and get his Florida Department of Children and Family Services to go and take her out of the hospice, to take, I guess for want of a better term, physical possession of Terri Schiavo.
That would be awesome. Send in the black booted thugs.
Yeah, yeah. Well, see, it's interesting. He decided against it, which I think makes...
Well, he's saner than his brother.
Yeah, he is saner than his brother. But I don't understand, and I sometimes question the sanity of some of the people in Congress on this. This is a Congress, ladies and gentlemen, that has made as one of its top priorities amending medical malpractice law. And a Congress that is prepared, apparently, and a president of the United States who is prepared to cut several billion dollars out of Medicare. And yet, what has kept Terri Schiavo alive all these years?
Yeah, tort reform would have killed her.
Tort reform would have killed her. If she hadn't won a $1 million judgment, she wouldn't have been able to live 15 years, my guess is. And, you know, she's also been getting federal government money.
That's right. What's so tragic in this whole thing is that, unfortunately, it puts progressives in the position of looking as if we don't care about Terri Schiavo or we want her to die. And, of course, obviously nothing could be further from the truth. I mean, we have to focus the spotlight on the fact that these Republicans don't give a damn about Terri Schiavo,
and that's what
this is really all about. There's those Social Security ads with the, the National Democrats haven't thought of any, haven't put forward any major ideas on Social Security, none. And I keep thinking that MoveOn or someone like that ought to do an ad showing a calendar passing from 1990 to 2005 through all the national Republicans who were prominent through that period. George Bush, 41, Newt Gingrich in 94, Bob Dole running in 96, and just back in 1995, who was talking about Terri Schiavo, who was talking about her in 99? No one.
Nobody.
No one gave a damn about her. She's just convenient.
It's amazing. They have pulled out every stop here. They bring in a doctor who says she's not in a persistent vegetative state. Turns out he's part of some bioethics Christian group, and there are questions about some nomination for a Nobel Prize, which apparently he never got, all right?
Okay.
But Jeb Bush parades this guy, I believe his name is Dr. Cheshire, as a Nobel nominee, a brilliant man, a man whose judgment on this should not be questioned. There have been...
Maybe he's working on that global warming stuff.
Yeah, too. Maybe he's doing that too,
working
right?
for the tobacco companies.
And then you have allegations, and this is where I really have a problem with the Schindler family, making allegations that Michael Schiavo somehow has abused his wife over this time. And
it's
that's
beyond
the reason.
Contempt.
Yeah, it is.
Nobody knows what happened there. And I think, if you read up at all about Michael Schiavo, you just know that he's had an incredible cross to bear all these years. You just have to give people the benefit of the doubt. Throwing around these kind of allegations without any evidence whatsoever is just disgusting.
One of our callers the day before yesterday said that they had made Michael Schiavo out to be Scott Peterson, and I think they're absolutely right in terms of the public perception. I saw some of the people who are supporting the parents on this, both clergy people and others, and there's something about it scares me. They busted a guy who apparently was trying to get a gun to go rescue Terri Schiavo the other day, right?
Great.
Hey, that's...
God bless America.
That is the back end of this. And it's the thing, Ted, that scared me about it since the developments earlier this week, that some nut job was going to end up trying to do something stupid in a gesture about Terri Schiavo.
Or to Michael.
He's had
to hire armed guards to protect himself.
So is Judge Greer.
Yeah, it's ridiculous, all the nuts that are out there. I mean, I know, as a cartoonist, sometimes I hear from these guys.
I'm coming to your house.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe they're buying those 100,000 AK-47s from Hugo Chavez.
Yeah, right. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk more about the Terri Schiavo case. We've got the Reverend Barry Lynn coming up in this hour. We're going to talk a little bit about how the Republican Party has been divided, and how perhaps it has also consolidated its right-wing movement around some stuff that is going to be very, very difficult to defend politically. When we come back here on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on the air and online. MorningSedition.com. Air America Radio.
Are you...
minutes past the hour. This is Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is back on Monday. And a special good morning to all of those people who are pimping off the pain of Terri Schiavo. I just want to say a special good morning to the Traditional Values Coalition, who actually is collecting money to help save Terri Schiavo's life. This is on their website.
Hey, someone should make some coin out of this.
Well, yeah, the coin of the realm, apparently. But, the Schiavo, the Schindler family, has their own website. Says that their website is the only place that you can legitimately contribute to Terri Schiavo's defense.
Excellent.
Yeah,
it's great.
Apparently,
the web wars are among us.
The religious right has opened its collective pocketbook and are making some very serious contributions. Not to be cynical, you understand, but...
No, of course not.
No, never that.
I mean, I don't even understand it. I mean, frankly, okay, I'm pro-choice. But I understand the pro-life position. I respect it. I think it's legitimate. It's not one of those, like, you know, it's not like being for the war in Iraq, where only a lunatic could be for that.
Right.
But you know, if you were pro-life, why would you think that the Terry Schiavo case was going to cause the overturning of Roe v. Wade? One is not going to lead to the other. They have nothing to do with each other. It's just this empty symbol. It's a battle that people like Tom DeLay know that they can't win. That the law isn't on their side. Even the Supreme Court won't touch it. Their pet Supreme Court, installed their president, right? So what are they thinking? I mean, what are pro-lifers? Why would they fall for this?
I guess they're kind of sort of solidifying the base. I mean, at least DeLay and the politicians that are involved in this. But we got a phone call. We want to get the opinion of one of our callers. Let's say good morning to Glenn, who's calling us from Long Island. How you doing?
All right. How are you guys?
Good, Glenn.
Well, you know, what strikes me about this whole argument is it's way too late, and it's just being opportunist at this time, because when you enter hospice care, the patient or the guardian signs papers way back at that point that says there's nothing medically that can be done. Hospice is only responsible for pain management until natural death, and there's no return to medical treatment because you're admitting that there's no place for you to go medically.
Great point.
Is that true under Florida law? Do you know that, Glenn?
I'm not sure in Florida. I've dealt with it in New York and in a couple of other states. I don't know in Florida, but, I mean, that seems to be pretty universal from my experience.
Yeah, it sounds right.
That's point of hospices, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense that the fight comes at this point, you know?
Well, yeah, and for a lot of reasons it doesn't. Glenn, thank you very much for that call. It doesn't make sense that the fight is coming at this point, but the reason why the fight's coming at this point is because politicians can make hay out of fighting at this point.
This is not about Terry Schiavo. That's exactly the problem. I mean, it is all about pandering to the Christian right and to send this wink, wink, nudge, nudge. We're on your side. We got your back. We're covered. We're on this culture of life bench. Yeah, of course we killed 100,000 Iraqis, but we're pro-life. And, you know, and that's their thing. And they're just sending out that wink out to the right.
To the base.
That's it.
Yeah.
Now, I don't even think it's working, but, you know, that's what they're trying to do.
But now we have to ask a tougher and much harder question. Absent those people who, for example, in the Congress decided to vote with the Republicans because they had some spiritual, philosophical reason for thinking that the case ought to go to federal court, where the hell have the rest of the Democrats been on this?
Oh, well, in absentia, right? I mean,
yeah.
they've been lying low, as they have been, you know, arguably, for the last 20 years. But they're not, these people are asleep, and they think that they can't get anything out of it. And that's always wrong. Standing up for the principle of the rule of law is something that everyone can respect, even people who might think that Terry Schiavo should be allowed to continue on her feeding tube, right? I mean, people, if you're an American, you have to respect the rule of law. And if you don't, then you're not, you're something else. You're not American.
Yeah, I would say that truly would be an un-American way of looking at the world. And I don't understand for the life of me why the Democrats are, in my judgment, repeating the same mistakes they have made in the recent past with being too timid on issues. And again, put aside the politics of the issue for the moment. Stand up and say, well, now we had Barney Frank, congressman from Massachusetts, on the air with us yesterday. Barney Frank stood up. Barney Frank spoke his mind. Barney Frank
says he always
does. Yeah, he does. And I think he, from my judgment, spoke truth. But there have been so few other people, and even Congressman Frank had difficulty explaining why the Democrats are so. I mean, he did say, well, you know, there are some people who say that, you know, if it's somebody that's vulnerable in their district or in their home state, in the case of the Senate, they don't want to say anything that's going to cause them to lose an election. But that kind of timidity, I got to tell you, Ted, isn't going to win us too many elections around here.
No, I mean, and the thing is, you know, you hear this even from people who are swing voters who people will say, you know, I voted for Bush or the Republicans because I feel like they believe in something, even if it's not something that I agree with.
Yeah.
And with the Democrats, you know, forget about the Democratic base. The people who are watching the parties look at these Democrats in this Terry Schiavo situation, and they say, they have no principles. They don't stand for anything. They don't come up with anything. They can't say, forget about why they feel a certain way. They can't say that they feel a certain way. So, you know, why should anyone support them? You can't trust them. You can't trust them to stand up for themselves. How are they going to stand up for you as a citizen?
And how are people going to, I mean, why couldn't the Democrats point out the ultimate hypocrisy in spending all this time and effort on Terri Schiavo while a six-month-old black child in Texas ends up being taken off life support because his mother can't afford to keep him there anymore? That they don't say anything about. They don't say anything about the very obvious contradiction of Terri Schiavo's having won a malpractice award while the Republicans are cutting malpractice awards. I mean, why can't the Democrats at least say that much?
Or the fact that Governor Bush, when he was the governor of Texas, signed a law that would have prohibited exactly this sort of thing from happening.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, these guys are just... Democrats miss so many opportunities. I mean, that was what my last book was about, all about those stupid missed opportunities. The book could have been longer.
Well, you know who did take advantage of an opportunity? The person that we've got coming up after the break. The Reverend Barry Lynn is the director, executive director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State. He's done the heavy lifting that the Democrats have not. He's the one that got a hold of, exposed, and disseminated a tape of Tom DeLay at his absolute wackiest. And I do mean absolute wackiest. We'll play that for people who haven't had a chance to hear it, and we'll talk to the Reverend Barry Lynn live when we come back here on Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
What?
Minutes past the hour. That's 26 minutes before the hour. This is Air America Radio's Morning's Edition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is back on Monday. Our very special guest co-host is none other than cartoonist extraordinaire and Kyrgyzstan expert, Mr. Ted Rawl. Good morning, Ted.
Good morning, Mark.
Thanks for being with us again.
Thank you for having me.
We've got a very special guest who's on our telephone lines this morning. This is a man who's been doing some of the heavy lifting that the Democrats have somehow found it impossible to do. We're talking about the executive director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State. He's joining us by telephone from Atlanta, Georgia. Let us welcome the Reverend Barry Lynn. Good morning, Reverend.
Good morning. It's nice to be back.
Thank you so much for being with us. Yes, Reverend Lynn has been a frequent guest on Air America Radio. You may even hear his promos of our show every now and then. Reverend Barry Lynn, first of all, let me ask you right off the top. How did you get this explosive tape of Tom DeLay speaking to the Family Research Council last Friday?
Well, I'll tell you, someone who was in attendance at that meeting provided us with the tape, and we had it, of course, by Monday morning, and were able to start distributing it. And occasionally people say, well, maybe you had a spy there. Look, whatever was the case, the important thing is what's on that tape. And the important thing about that tape is that Tom DeLay is saying to the religious right, I will carry your water on every social issue, but you've got to give me the cloak of Christian cover when my ethics problems really start to emerge. And I think when you get top officials, Mark and Ted, of the Republican Party, the leadership party, in theory at least, meeting with the religious right, planning legislation that affects every single American eventually, I think the public has a right to know, and that's why we released the tape.
It was a waiter, wasn't it? It was one of the guys working the room that morning, wasn't it?
It was actually a very intelligent fly on the wall who was able to operate a tape recorder.
Now, is this something that you can't just happen to come into, or was there a plant?
Well, we just expected that these kinds of things are often said behind closed doors. When people are talking to their core constituency, we just didn't realize, frankly, that anyone would provide us with something of this explosive magnitude. Because this is about the rawest exercise. When you look at the last week, the rawest exercise of power by the religious right that I have ever seen. And remember, I've been watching them since their, shall we say, less than virginal birth back in the 1970s. And they have never tried to pull a stunt like this. Take an issue of this significance, ram it through Congress, and now, shock upon shock, The latest CNN poll yesterday shows that 82% of the American people believe the Congress, including Tom DeLay, Bill Frist, all these other characters, should never have gotten involved in this case.
Incredible.
I'm in the 18%. I really want Tom DeLay to decide whether I live or die.
He's coming to your house, actually, in about an hour and a half.
Excellent. I'll be waiting by the door.
Now, Reverend Barry Lynn, did you or your organization know in advance that this breakfast was taking place that Tom DeLay would be speaking at?
No, actually, Tom DeLay was not originally intended. He wasn't even on the schedule. He wasn't even on the program. This was all very fortuitous.
He inserted himself into this breakfast? He kind of like, hey, I'm not doing anything. Let me go have some breakfast with some of my peeps.
Well, what had happened, as I understand it, is that some of the earlier speakers had perhaps suggested that Mr. DeLay wasn't doing enough. So they decided to call in Tom DeLay.
A shirking violet.
Who was in the men's room at the hotel.
Everybody has to do that at some point.
Yeah,
He wasn't anticipated to be there. Bill Frist was, but he had to speak to them by telephone. But they did haul Tom in. But remember, Tom's got an enormous stake in all of this because, as you know, and Air America has certainly talked about more than any other news outlet, Tom DeLay's got problems in terms of ethics lapses, potentially more ethics lapses, if that's possible, in Washington, and also still facing this grand jury in Texas. He wants to be able to say to these extraordinarily talkative, noisy minority of, say, 18% of the population that characterizes itself as the religious right, I need your help. You have to make sure that they don't do to me what they did to Terri Schiavo. He had the gall to compare himself to Terri Schiavo. He said, well, that's...
Well, it's because he's brain dead.
Yeah, right. Now, we're going to play that little piece, Reverend, for people who haven't heard it before. We're going to show you how, show our listening audience, because you've already heard this, obviously. We're going to show our listening audience exactly how Tom DeLay created a fabric out of his troubles and Terri Schiavo's pain.
This is a huge nationwide concerted effort to destroy everything we believe in. And you need to look at this and what's going on and participate and fighting back. Don't, you know, the one way they stopped churches from getting into politics is Lyndon Johnson, who passed a law that said you couldn't get in politics or you're going to lose your tax exempt status because they were all opposed to him when he was running for president. That law we're trying to repeal. It's very difficult to do that. But the point is when they can knock out a leader, then no other leader will step forward for a while because they don't want to go through the same thing. But if they go after him and get a pastor, then other pastors shrink from what they should be doing. It forces Christians back into the church, and that's what's going on in America. The world is too bad, I'm going to go get inside this building, and I'm not going to play in the world. That's not what Christ asked us to do. And so they understand that. It is a political maneuver, and they are going to try to destroy the conservative movement, and we have to fight back.
You know, Reverend Barry Lynn, I was almost speechless when I first heard this. You are a man of the cloth. What was your reaction when you heard a politician invoking Christ and what Christ should have us do?
Well, you know, when politicians do it, it's a lot different than if your local pastor where you're sitting in his or her church tells you how you ought to act. That's what normally happens in church. But when hardball politicians like Tom DeLay start telling us, explaining to us that Jesus has somehow connected Terri Schiavo with him, Tom DeLay, I'd have to say he must be talking to a different God than I talk to. But one of the other fascinating things about that speech is the notion that the conservative movement is being destroyed by people, I guess, like me, that we're in a syndicate, was the word he used.
Yes.
A syndicate. The conservatives have control of the House. They have control of the Senate. They have control of the presidency. They have at least 4.5 out of the 9 votes on the Supreme Court. How in the world is this the destruction of the conservative movement? Now,
Well, it's the destruction of Tom DeLay, Reverend.
Of course.
And therefore, the destruction of everything that is good and proper in the world. Have you, Reverend, have you heard from any truly conservative Christians about how they feel about Tom DeLay's and the other cynical Republicans in Congress's attempt to exploit this issue?
Well, actually, I have, and I've heard them on as they call into other talk shows and to talk to me on those shows, and I've done a couple of colleges in the last few nights and heard them there, too. And the polling is now showing as high as 67% of self-described evangelical Christians also oppose what Tom DeLay did. But now, here, guys, is the spin from the right starting about last evening. Here's the spin. It says, look, Tom DeLay sees these poll results. 82% of Americans disapprove of what he did. That proves that Tom DeLay is a man of singular moral courage because
exactly.
He doesn't care about the polls. Now, I
of course.
Say if Tom DeLay was a psychic and had seen these poll results last Friday, that guy would have gone on a fact-finding mission to Mars instead of calling the Congress back to Washington
last weekend.
Good point. You know, Reverend Lynn, one of the things that struck me about the piece that we just played is his call to get involved. Because what we're seeing now, apparently, is the conservative right that agrees with Tom DeLay and agrees with the Schindler family opening up their wallets in unprecedented numbers and amounts. There are several different groups, including a group that has been formed by the Schindler family, that are actually raising funds. And in fact, the Traditional Values Coalition, your good friend the Reverend Lou Sheldon,
right,
has a Help Save Terry Schiavo's Life part of their website where they're taking donations. What do you think of all that?
Look, these guys are going to play this to the hilt. They're going to collect as much money as possible, even though they know that there is no legitimate legal basis for anything. I know there'll be another appeal, probably to the full 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, another one to the Supreme Court. These are all going to fail. It's over unless that you literally believe with the fringiest of the religious right characters you see occasionally screeching on television that Jeb Bush or to pull an Elian Gonzalez, or to kick down the door of the hospice and drag her out. There are certainly people in this movement capable of engaging in violence down in Florida, but I don't think even they could convince Jeb Bush that he has any kind of moral or legal authority to do that. But they're going to raise this money. Listen, on a talk show, a right-wing talk show earlier in the week, when they were collecting money to pay off Michael Schiavo, you know, they had raised over $2 million.
What?
Yeah, they had raised over $2 million of funds that to say, if you will get a divorce, Mr. Schiavo, we'll give you the money. And a guy called
in. Oh, that's nothing like protecting the sanctity of marriage.
No,
and there's a doofus on radio named Glenn Beck. I don't know if you guys know him, but he actually was getting calls like from a guy who said he would also give Michael Schiavo a lifetime supply of his homemade cheesecakes. I am not making this up.
Well, wait a minute. How good is this cheesecake?
Yeah, how good?
I like cheesecake.
Is this New York cheesecake?
Well, no, wait a minute. I have an answer for that. It's low-fat cheesecake.
Oh,
don't tell me how good it could possibly be.
No one's life's going to be saved by low-fat cheesecake.
And, you know, Reverend, there actually is
a
guy.
It's terrible. It's a disgrace.
There's a guy from Rockford, Illinois, who was arrested last night going into trying to pull a knife in a gun store in Seminole, Florida, because he wanted to steal a gun to rescue Terry Schiavo.
Yes, and a bomb threat also at the district court last night. People talk about the religious right, and they think Jerry Falwell, and I'll tell you, I know Jerry Falwell. He's not likely to pick up a weapon and go shoot somebody. Even some of the people that you see down there, like Reverend Pat Mahoney, I've known those guys all my life. They're not going to pick up guns, but they're people even more fringy. They're the people who kill the doctors who provide the abortions that women want around this country. They're completely crazed. They are dangerous. And that's one of the things that I worry about as we slip into, for Christians, the holiest days of the year, that we're going to find some fanatic who does some terrible thing.
Well, let's certainly hope not. But, you know,
we got to take a break.
Okay.
Our guest is the Reverend Barry Lynn. He's Executive Director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Reverend, can you stay with us for a minute? We're going to take
Absolutely.
A quick break. We're going to come back, talk some more about this issue and about how perhaps we can get more of our Democratic politicians involved in this. Stay with us. This is Air America Radio.
Hi, this is Mike Mills from REM, and you are listening to Mark and Mark on Morning Sedition here on Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. This is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. You know, every time Chris Lopresto, our board operator, points at me, I'm really tempted to just, like, wait and to have him keep going, pointing, pointing, pointing over and over again.
Just let him totally panic.
Yeah, really. Our special guest, first of all, our guest co-host is none other than Mr. Ted Raw, political cartoonist extraordinaire, our guest on the phone line from Atlanta, Georgia. We're so happy to have him with us, the executive director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State, the Reverend Barry Lynn. Reverend Barry Lynn, are you as upset with the Democratic silence on the Shivo case as many of our listeners and, quite frankly, Ted and I are?
Yes, absolutely. I think it was a pretty pathetic showing last Sunday night and early Monday morning. Obviously, you know, I was listening to you guys the other day. You have my friend Congressman Jerry Nadler on, one of the great leaders when it comes to these constitutional issues. He's a guy, you know, that has understood from the beginning that Democrats have plenty of values. And one of the things that Jerry Nadler and Barney Frank and some of the other folks that did speak out do have is an understanding of constitutional values. These ideas that liberty matters, that privacy matters, that the intimate decisions that people make shouldn't be second-guessed by a bunch of pseudo-psychic politicians who are trying to do medical diagnoses while sitting on their can in Washington, looking at videotapes of Terry Schiavo that are 4 years old, but there weren't enough of those Democrats. This is a message. This is a spin. I think it's the truth, though, but this is what I'd like to hear Democrats saying. You know, probably now the religious right has gone too far. When they talk about being pro-family, what they really mean is not just that they want to control their family, but they want to control your family. That's wrong. Let's get some momentum behind the idea that the religious right always has been too far out. This was the proof, and let's run with it.
That, well, that's, you know, there's a quote in that tape that we played of DeLay where he says, you know, it forces Christians back into the church.
Gee, I wonder what's wrong with that.
In the public sphere, isn't that pretty much what our Constitution says?
Well, you know, I wouldn't quite go that far, Ted, because I do think that the Christians have as much opportunity and right to articulate their views in the public square as anybody else.
Absolutely.
The issue is that the politicians have to understand that they are not making judgments in a theocracy. Even Congressman Shays, Republican from Connecticut, said that the party of Lincoln, he's a Republican, the party of Lincoln had become a party of theocracy. That's a pretty extraordinary statement, but a theocracy is a government run along religious law, not secular law. And the truth is, we've got a constitution, and members of Congress can listen to any of these characters they want, but then they have to say, okay, but now what does the Constitution require?
But they're trying to change all that. That's not what they want to do. They want to change the very nature of our constitutional system to make us look closer to something like Iran than what we started out with.
No, you're absolutely right. And I think your listeners, I mean, I know it's important to talk about Social Security and all of that, but I think in the next couple of weeks, the single most important thing for your listeners to know is that Bill Frist still wants to exercise what has been called the nuclear option, which is to eliminate filibusters in the United States Senate, at least for judicial nominees and maybe for all legislation. If he gets that, what we're going to see is more of this runaway activity on more and more issues where a bare majority of the Senate is able to railroad through any screwy ideas they've got. Anti-church state separation, anti-free speech, anti-reproductive rights. If we do not get 51 votes to oppose changing the filibuster rules, this country is in bigger trouble than it has ever seen in modern political history.
No doubt. You know, I could almost live with the nuclear option, actually, if I felt that when Democrats got back into control of the House and got back into control of the Senate, that they weren't going to just wuss out and then change it back.
You know,
because
right.
I want to use the nuclear option myself.
Yeah, well, trust me, in the event that the nuclear option, for example, is exercised, they will push bills through, including the one that Tom DeLay was mumbling about in that tape, to allow churches, no other charities, but only churches, to endorse and support candidates for office. These big mega churches, I just was speaking at Emory in Atlanta last night, you go past these churches that are, they're bigger than God's House, I think. I mean, they're enormous places with teen centers and possibly swimming pools and salad bars. Also, they all will be organized by the right-wing Republicans to defeat any candidate of the Democratic Party or any moderate Republicans. We cannot allow him to do away with the law that says churches cannot, from the pulpit, endorse candidates. They can't take money from the collection plate and spend it on their favorite candidates. But that's what that little mumbo-jumbo that he's talking about, Lyndon Johnson, that's what it means.
Reverend Barry Lynn, thank you so much for being with us
this
morning.
It's always a pleasure.
And thank you so much for doing the heavy work that our politicians ought to be doing, all right?
Yeah,
all
no
right.
doubt about it.
I'm not running for anything.
There you go. You take care.
Bye-bye, guys.
Bye.
The Reverend Barry Lynn, Executive Director of Americans United for Church and State. When we come back, I've got a little dog of the week story for you, Ted. Yeah, now, you know, the Shivo thing would have been real easy to find some dogs if I would find a different dog of the week, however. Plus, your homie, Ward Sutton, another political cartoonist, joins us in studio when we come back here on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Cholesterol.
Six minutes past the hour. Good morning. It's Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley with our very special guest co-host, Ted Rawl. And, of course, Mark Maron will be back here on Monday. And I want to say a special good morning today to alleged organized crime marijuana farmers here in New York whose wives say, "We just need a little help with the bills." That's right. That's a quote in today's news right here in New York.
We all need a little help with the bills.
I guess so. And, of course, all of this is alleged. But, Ted, how you doing?
I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm doing great. And, of course, before our hour's done this morning, we're going to be talking with one of your homies, cartoonist Ward Sutton.
That's right. My fellow cartoonist in the Village Voice and many other newspapers.
Fellow seditionist, huh? Troublemaker?
We tried. That's the job description. Too few of us actually do it, but...
Why is that? Why do too few of you actually do it?
It's scary, and there's so much pressure not to do it. You know, there's besides the hate mail, you get canceled from newspapers. Editors don't want to have anything to do with you. To be any good, you have to be willing to piss people off, and pissing people off pisses people off. Yeah, so you know, it's not about being popular. It's about being good, and about being right.
There you go. Well, it's that time again. Time for Mark Riley's Dog of the Week. You know, Ted, under certain... Hey, shut up.
Is that Tom DeLay?
Yeah, right. Under certain circumstances, this week's dog would be easy. We could have simply chosen any one of the cabal of GOP jihadists who decided to make their bones on the back of poor Terri Schiavo. But overreaching Republicans are a dime a dozen in George W. Bush's America. No, our dog comes from a different place. Ted, you ever hear of phone bombing?
No, I haven't.
It's the practice of calling in phony police emergencies, then seeing how many cops respond. Sound like fun? Not for the good people of New Brunswick, New Jersey. They suffered a day-long siege earlier this week, during which police SWAT teams cordoned off an entire neighborhood. Somebody called the cops and said a 14-year-old girl was being held hostage and had been raped. Turned out, the whole thing was a hoax. The perpetrator? 24-year-old Fatine Ann Ward of Arlington, Texas. That's right, Arlington, Texas. This allegedly bipolar convicted sex offender called in an emergency to law enforcement in Jersey from her Texas home. It wasn't a lot of laughs for the three teens who were taken in handcuffs from a New Brunswick, New Jersey apartment house. They were first thought to be the hostage takers. But it just turns out they had the bad judgment to belong to the same internet chat room as our good friend Ms. Ward. By the way, police now suspect she's done this more than a dozen times. So, Fatin Ward, you've phone-bombed your way into a prison cell, and you've also phone-bombed your way into the title of Morning Sedition Dog of the Week. The growl part's going to have
is
to
that
wait.
A real, that's not a real dog.
That's Crystal Presto.
Oh, yeah, okay. I knew that. Because you can sort of hear it at the end.
Yeah, I know, I know. Ooh. I don't know. The growl thing, does it sound like a real growl?
Yeah, the growl is great.
The growl is good. Okay. Because that's Chris, too.
Yeah.
He does all our voices.
Okay. You know, keep the growl, and we've got to tweak that end part.
Now, when Ted, how do you, what kind of environment, I've always wondered this about creative people, what kind of environment do you need to do your best work as far as cartooning is concerned? Because you really have to put together the artistic part, the drawing, and with a political train of thought. What works best?
Well, I think it's probably different for every cartoonist. For me, I like to get amped on a lot of coffee and Ooh. Absorb a lot of bad Fox News and MSNBC and CNN. You know, you absorb a lot of stuff, but it's really, I think, the best kind of creative situation that you can make for yourself is the space to decide that you're going to be willing to draw about absolutely anything in any kind of way that strikes you at the moment. And you really have to start to trust your instincts. I mean, you know, when you first start out, you don't know what's going to work, you know, and you throw a lot of stuff at the wall, and a lot of it just falls flat, and for a variety of reasons. I mean, you know, I've had cartoons that went sour because I expected that people had read a story that I had read and found interesting. But even if something's in the New York Times on page one, it might not capture the national zeitgeist in any kind of meaningful way. Like, you know, in the 6 o'clock hour, we're talking about Kyrgyzstan, right? But I don't think Kyrgyzstan's going to take the nation by storm. Today we're talking about Terry Schiavo and Social Security. Those are really the only two stories that are really capturing the imagination and the attention of the American public. So as a cartoonist, I have to decide, well, you know, do I want to do a Kyrgyzstan cartoon and try to educate my readers and say, like, look, this is important and this is why? Or do I want to do something about Terry Schiavo, which, of course, unfortunately, The Herd is doing also.
The Herd is doing it, and if you did not get a chance to hear it earlier, federal judge James Whitmore in Tampa, Florida, has refused to order the reinsertion of Terry Schiavo's feeding tube. This was a case that he got, apparently, about 6 o'clock last night. The Schindler family, Terry Schiavo's mother and father, went back to the federal courts yet again to try and get Judge Whitmore on a different set of grounds than they had gone the previous 25 times they'd gone. And Judge Whitmore has again said no.
You know, if we had the Schindler family go after Osama bin Laden, they might have actually found him.
Yeah, at Tora Bora, as a matter of fact.
They're looking.
They're
relentless.
They're leaving no stone unturned here. I mean, it is unbelievable the extent to which they're going. And, again, you know, they have an emotional stake in this. Many of their Absolutely. Supporters, I have to say, do not. Many of their supporters are in it for themselves, and not just the politicians. I've seen some of those folks, you know, they look like swamis or something. You know, it's like these guys.
It's such a bestiary of BS down there.
I know,
it is,
man.
So bizarre.
I'm expecting somebody to start, you know, conjuring snakes out of baskets or something. There are people down there that are involved in this that got no business. Some of them seem to be, you know, from the Maris Lacis Gonzalez School of Drama, where they, you know, try and act out the way she did during the Elian Gonzalez case down in Florida just a few years ago.
Do you think these guys ask their boss for the week off, you know?
Yeah. I got to go down to protest.
Yeah, Schiavo. Got to go.
Yeah.
Schiavo, 5 days.
Yeah, bye. Somebody can take it. I need the vacation time, man.
Yeah, Florida's nice at this time of the year.
Yeah, it's warm. Yeah. Warmer than up here. I don't know. It just seems to me that there are an awful lot of people that are making hay out of this case. Now, I don't know where the family goes next. I'm sure they're going somewhere.
I think they're going to a funeral next.
Oh, wow. You think so?
Yeah, I think, look, let's face it, the U.S. Supreme Court has refused to do anything about this. The polls are running 82% against Bush and his minions. I mean, you know, they're out of options.
Well, Bush has already backed off. I think he says he doesn't read polls, but I think he read this one because he's been sort of, well, I'm really sad, but there's nothing else I can do.
Yeah, I know. The guy flies all the way back from his ranch, right, to sign this bill.
But, yeah.
You know, I mean, he couldn't be bothered back in August of 2001 to come back from Washington, to come back to Washington.
After September 11th!
Yeah, after getting that memo that said that Al-Qaeda was going to attack, he couldn't be bothered to, he can't be bothered to interrupt his vacation for anything. So, obviously, it went from being a very high priority matter to a very low, to a back burner thing.
To a back burner thing. His brother, Jeb Bush, seems to be trying to burnish his conservative credentials with the same Christian jihadists who helped elect his brother. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I like to call them the Christianists.
The Christianists, yeah.
It's a great word, you know. Because if there's Islamists, there's got to be Christianists.
Man, what scares me about this, Ted, is that I can see a scenario under which these people really begin to think that they can take over the country. When I keep hearing...
they're close already.
I know. I keep hearing Tom Dillon saying, we got to fight this. We got to fight this.
Yeah, they're the underdogs, right? That's always their rhetoric.
I'm scared.
We're fighting back. We're mad as hell. We can't take it anymore.
Take what anymore?
You're doling it out. You're dishing it out.
Yeah, I mean, it reminds me of that scene from The Godfather. Do we have to kill all our enemies?
Yes.
I mean, it scares me because I'm beginning to think that some of these people believe that they do have to literally fight. And that's scary. I can see at some point in the future, if this sort of thing keeps going like this, some really overt attack. Can you imagine if a couple hundred people marched on a courthouse somewhere and said, hey, Whitmore, we want you. And I'm not trying to be paranoid about this. I'm trying to scare people with this. But remember, when they tried to do the vote count over again down in Florida 5 years ago, what happened?
That's right. They had sent a bunch of hired goons from actually whose office was that? Oh, that's right. Tom DeLay's office.
With help from our good friend Roger Stone here in New York, the probably the strangest political consultant in the history of politics. Well, he's the only one on a website with his allegedly with his wife talking about wife swapping or something. That's a whole other discussion.
Jeff Gannon.
I know. It's 15 minutes past the hour. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I'm going to tell you about a ruling, a kind of troubling ruling that is coming out of our neighbors to the north and some problems that the armed forces are having with getting people down with the program. When we come back here on Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition.
On our highest rated, most respected news show in America.
On Air America Radio.
The hour. This is Morning's Edition. My name is Mark Riley. Our special guest co-host is none other than political cartoonist Mr. Ted Raw. And we're going to talk about things military because there are a couple of things that are going on in the world that you, our listeners, ought to know about. Those of you who are thinking about the Army, you're fast becoming in the minority. You know, Ted, the other
day... But you call it thinking, really.
Yeah, you're right. The other day we had Congressman Jerry Nadler here, and we talked about whether or not the shortage of soldiers for the war in Iraq might eventually lead to a draft. He didn't think so, but right now the Army Secretary, Francis Harvey, is agreeing with him and saying the D word is the farthest thing from my mind. But the facts are these. The Army missed its recruiting goal for February by 27%. First time it had missed a monthly goal since May of 2000. Last time it missed a full year goal was in 1999. This is the first time the U.S. has been in a sustained period of combat, of course, since the all-volunteer force was introduced in 1973. The regular Army, down 6% in the number of recruits. Army Reserve, 10% off. Army National Guard, 25% off. And, of course, African Americans are turning away from the Army in surprisingly large numbers. The African Americans have always been a disproportionate share of the armed forces, and specifically the Army. Well, the proportion is staying relatively the same, but the fact is recruits are going down. And it looks like, Ted, people just don't want to be bothered with this. They don't want to go overseas and get killed.
Well, there's not much to recommend it, is there? I mean, the pay sucks. You can get just as much money starting salary at McDonald's. Yeah. The risk is high. Let's face it. You know, we've all heard that, you know, if you know anyone in the military, anyone who's serving overseas, they'll tell you those guys don't have the right armor. They don't have the right vehicles. They don't have the right weaponry. They just don't, you know, the fact is that despite all the high-flying rhetoric that you hear coming out of Washington, the truth is that the Pentagon doesn't care about the soldiers, and the stories come home. These guys, I think a big part of the story is that people come back to the neighborhood and they tell people how it was.
Word of mouth is a hell of a thing.
Word of mouth is a terrible thing. I mean, you know, so what's, you know, what's good about it? It's a, you know, I don't even think ethics comes into it, you know, whether the war is right or whether Saddam had anything to do with 9/11 or any of that. That doesn't even matter. It's just a bad job.
Well, and yeah, and I think that is what a lot of people go into service for. They figure they will find some marketable skill. You know, if you go into the armed forces and you learn how to fix helicopters, you can come out and go down here a couple of blocks away
That's
and
right.
you fix helicopters, make a good living for yourself and your family. If you learn how to do some of these other technical skills, which is why the Air Force continues to do well in its recruitment, they meet their goals. Because those are considered specialized skill kinds of jobs that you can do in the Air Force, where on the other hand, carrying an AK-47, or not an AK-47, carrying
an M1.
Yeah, is it still
M16?
An M1?
No, M16. M16, sorry. That's right.
Yeah, whatever it is that they carry.
Those things that shoot people.
Yeah, it's a whole different thing. And people are starting to realize now that there is the possibility. You know, in years past, people would go in and they say, well, there's really no possibility that I'm going to end up having to fight anybody.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not going in for that. I'm going into, well, not anymore, particularly in the National Guard. And you see, you know, I have a National Guard armory near my house. And I remember because my wife and daughter and I came out early one morning when one of the National Guard units was being deployed, simply because we wanted to show some sympathy and support for the soldiers, not for the war.
No.
Not for George W. Bush, but for the soldiers who are interrupting their lives, who are leaving their families.
And that's not what the National Guard is for.
No, it's
not. It never
not.
Was.
No.
And, you know, the truth is that this is a backdoor draft for an unpopular war. You know, the war in Iraq has fallen in popularity well below 50%. People now realize that they've been lied to. I mean, even you can't even really get any straight-talking Republicans to really say that Saddam had WMDs or that we weren't lied to about the ties to al-Qaeda.
Maybe
any
Dick Cheney.
Of that stuff.
He's still...
Straight-talking Republicans.
Oh, you're right.
You know, no, it's just, you know, I mean, it's absurd. And I can't believe that really... I'm surprised that they get the numbers that they still get. I mean, it's a testimony to... obviously continuing unemployment and the despair in, you know, there's still huge swaths of the country where it's almost impossible to find a decent job when you come out of high school.
Yeah.
So people are driven into it.
But well, you know, it's funny. There are, at the same time this is going on, some people who have gone into the service and have been deployed to Iraq have chosen the avenue of leaving, deserting the service, and going up to Canada. And we spoke some months ago to Jeremy Hinsman, who was in exactly that situation. He had gone to Canada, asked for asylum because he didn't want to fight in what he considered to be an unjust war. And as it turns out, a board hearing refugee cases in Canada rejected Jeremy Hinsman's bid for asylum. He refused to go to Iraq, and now he faces possible deportation to the United States and desertion charges on the part of the Army.
That's shameful on the part of Canada. I mean, you know, the one thing that we could always count on is that the Canadian...
It's Canada!
It's Canada! You know, it's like if everything hits the fan, I can head north. And but, you know, in Canada's defense, Jeremy will be able to appeal this decision. He's not going to be deported just yet.
Oh, that's good. That's very good news. Now, he is from Rapid City, South Dakota. He had served in Afghanistan, but he left Fort Bragg and entered Canada in January of last year after the 82nd Airborne, his unit, was given orders to deploy to Iraq. So, I mean, he did in fact serve his country at one point, but
that's
now
true.
People are saying, you know, there because there have been numbers of people, the Canadians are estimated that there are 100 Americans, either service people or others, hiding in Canada from the armed forces.
Yeah.
So, you know,
those numbers are just going to rise.
Yeah, they are definitely going to rise as this.
And especially if the saber rattling with Iran or North Korea takes off, you know, then where are they going to get their troops? Then the D word has to come up. I mean, let's get real here. I mean, it's, you know, this government tries to get money from nothing, right? It's like, well, we don't have to raise taxes. We can spend as much as we want. We can fight two wars at the same time, and we don't have to, money is just, we'll just print more. It's the same thing. Well, they can't print more soldiers.
No, they can't, and they're not getting them through recruitment, not even by trying to get the parents to talk their kids into doing it. When we come back, cartoonist Ward Sutton is our very special guest as we roll on. Morning's Edition on Air America Radio. Don't forget, Raptor Watch coming up as well.
Morning's Edition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Hi, I'm Dan.
Four past the hour. This is Air America Radio's Morning's Edition. My name is Mark Riley, and our special guest co-host is none other than political cartoonist Mr. Ted Raw, and fellow traveler and also political cartoonist Ward Sutton is with us in studio. We'll be talking with him in a moment, but right now, the Bible's Book of Revelations portends the end of days and the second coming of the Christian Messiah. One of our president's favorite stories. Though no one knows when the end times will come, there are signs that will appear to men. Here on Morning's Edition, we won't let you be caught off guard by the end of the world. That's why we present this week's Rapture Watch with MILF Cardinal Milfington of the recently disgraced Diocese of the 8th Precinct in Manhattan. Your Grace?
Heed my alarm, ye blasphemous Ephesians, or blasphesians. Come up hither, thy Thessalonian idolaters, or Thessaloniters. Consider yourself warned, thou who mockest the God, by seeking succor at the withered man teats of Hazel, in the hidden valleys of Harnahab, Gehenna, and the Neverland Ranch. You have made your hearts the cages of unclean birds, and soon Polly will just want a cracker. He'll want your soul in a cracker. And I'll just keep repeating the phrase, pretty boy, pretty boy, over and over and over again with a stupid sunflower seed in his beak. For when midnight comes nigh, that will stand before the judgment throne of Christ, his apostles, and his pet mongoose, Chippers. Yeah, he's got a pet mongoose. Read your Bible, people. You may recall, last hebdomadal, I told you about a woman who found a human finger in her chili at Wendy's. The week before that, I told you about a man who was devoured by a noodle-making machine. And the week before that, I told you there probably wasn't a better time to sink all your money into the noodle and fast food industry. Okay, look, there's a reason why this segment's called Rapture Watch and not Business Watch, all right? I'm not your freaking accountant. And now, something even more insidious, more diabolical and more demonic has occurred as a sure end times indicator. A married couple in South Dakota is selling scented candles. Candles, they claim. Wait, I'm not through. Candles, they claim, bear the essence of Christ because they contain the oils of myrrh and cassia. Reality check, people. Myrrh and cassia run a gay health food store down the village. They're not part of Christ's essence. These candles are clearly seeds of the false Messiah, a sign of the approaching rapture. For it was prophesied in Revelation 12, 25, 17, hike! And I quote it, and the beast shall rise up from the ground, having six heads, six scented candles, and six scented sheets. And around him will he situate six scented candles for the six sheets, six sheets. Damn these Satan! I can't ever get that revelation right. Suffice it to say, these candles exist in the name of blasphemy. For the chicks to put around their bathtubs. Besides, everybody knows Jesus smelled a lot more butch. Buy one, and that will suffer everlasting torment where the worm dieth not. Or even worse, become a vegetable in Florida and have your fate decided by the Bush family. I don't need any reactions from the peanut gallery, please. Until then, fornicators, keep on fornicatoring, and we'll keep a light on for you. In hell.
Wow. Wow. You know, you and your family seem to have a whole thing with what's going on in Florida. Cardinal.
We're following it. Florida is a very suggestively shaped state.
Okay. Say hello to all the boys at the 8th Precinct for me, will you?
Whatever.
Cardinal Milthington with today's Rapture Watch. Right now, it's a pleasure to welcome to our microphones live in studio political cartoonist and creator of the political comic strip Sutton Impact. And his book comes out, a book by the same name, Sutton Impact, the political cartoons of our guest, Mr. Ward Sutton. Good morning.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's kind of like a cartoonist forum here now.
Yeah, yeah, really.
We're taking over.
Yeah. Well, Ted, actually, I'm going to the bathroom. You can do the heavy lifting from here. No.
All right.
Let me start out with a real simple question. What makes, in your judgment, Ward Sutton, a good political cartoon?
Well, I think a good political cartoon exposes some kind of truth that runs counter to the perceived conventional wisdom that's out there, using irony and humor. And I think it should have a clear opinion, and it should have the facts right. Counter to that, there are cartoons that just sort of seem to name-check a current event and without really commenting on it. I kind of think of them as like Nicktoons. You can probably jump in too, Ted. I don't know if you agree. But
those are, don't you think that's probably the majority, really, of what Americans, sadly, consider mainstream American political cartooning? I mean, the kind of stuff that you see in the Newsweek perspective section or in the Week in Review section of the New York Times, USA Today on Fridays, all these sort of generic, big city kind of political.
And they're all drawn the same. Like, you couldn't tell who drew it. You know, they all kind of look generally the same. A lot of times they'll have the same exact ideas. I remember years ago when, just as one example, when George Harrison died from the Beatles. I mean, first of all, like, the guy from the Beatles died. You don't need to do a political cartoon about that
at all.
It's like there are these death cartoons. It's like cartoonists take a day off day or something.
George Harrison is dead?
And it's sad. You're supposed to be sad.
So they make a cartoon that says, this is sad. You know, that's not commentary. I mean, do your job. You're supposed to comment on the news.
There was Joel Pett, who's a brilliant cartoonist from Lexington, Kentucky, did a slideshow of the obituary cartoons of the future. And they're all like tears coming out of things. And this was before Nixon died. And my favorite one was the tape. A tape with a tear underneath.
That's what the George Harrison ones were. They were like playing off of My Guitar Gently Weeps. I went on this website that just has all these generic cartoons. And at one after another was a guitar crying. You know, it's like, come on.
Let's name names. The website is, the infamous website is called Kegel.com, C-A-G-L-E. It's got all of these mainstream generic political cartoons. And it's amazing because they kind of have this sort of great minds think alike motif where you'll have, like, you know, after 9/11, there was the infamous example of I counted personally, 64 separate distinct examples of political cartoons depicting the Statue of Liberty weeping.
Wow.
Usually in various forms of smoke, clouds, fog, I don't know, whatever, atmospheric conditions of various sorts, depending on where you lived, you know. And people say, well, that's because it's the, that means it was a good idea. No, that meant it was a stupid idea.
It was the obvious idea, and that you have to move on. Yeah, and if you want to be a good cartoonist, you should be clever and look beyond the obvious.
Which so few do, but you're one of the few who does. I mean, who are some of the other cartoonists who you think do good work?
Well, I like, in terms of the daily cartoonist, I love Oliphant and Danziger, Tom Tolles,
great
people like that. And then, of course, my compadres, you and Tom Tomorrow and Ruben Bowling. I follow in The Voice, obviously. And that's
the Village Voice for people outside of New York City.
But I'd say I'm not only inspired by other cartoons, though. I get inspired by all sorts of things, like from The Daily Show and The Onion and David Reese, Get Your War on the Internet. You know, it's a whole different way of cartooning. But I think sometimes people perceive that if you're a cartoonist, you just love all cartoons. And in fact, I think you're even more critical of cartoons And
it takes the fun out of it, right? I mean,
yeah.
In a way, because you sort of, a lot of people will look at a joke that's, you know, kind of time, it uses a time-honored and time craft, you know, sort of craft that you recognize. And you look at it as someone, as a cartoonist, and you say, I know how that person did that.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's not, you know, you're just like, oh, that sucks.
Yeah. And, you know, the cartoons that don't offend anyone, that try to go along with the conventional wisdom, like, I'm just going to illustrate what everybody's thinking, is, you know, if you don't offend somebody, then you also don't connect to anybody, because you're just bland, you're just
Although
beige.
Offense is not the point, right?
It's not the point.
I think you've got to be willing.
You have to go out on a limb, I guess is what I'm trying to say. You have to go out and say something that you don't feel like other people are saying.
Well, no, that's really the key.
That gets to the whole idea of because you mentioned speaking truth, getting the facts straight.
Uh-huh.
When what is the cost of to a political cartoonist of speaking your own truth?
Unemployment, possibly.
Wow. Is it unemployment, Ward?
Well, you know, knowing how much I make as a cartoonist, it's, you know, being employed and unemployed is pretty close.
labor of love.
You can... you know, you cannot speak the truth and make a much better living than speaking the truth. For instance, I kind of made a big decision in 2000. Before that, I was trying to cater my cartoons to get into bigger publications, like get into the New York Times. I would think, hey, well, maybe if I kind of soften my words and my cartoons, the Times will pick this up this week or something, you know. And I have to admit, after the 2000 elections, I just felt like, forget that. I'm just going to say what I think, and I'm just going to hope it gets out there to people the way it gets out there. But my cartoons and a lot of Ted's, you could speak to this, but won't be picked up by a lot of publications because they have an opinion, you know. And
yeah.
For some reason, people don't like an opinion, and they don't like graphics telling an opinion. If you notice the New York Times op-ed page, they don't have cartoons that say anything anymore.
Yeah, you know, it's really funny. Last week... a group named gave an award named after Herb Bloch, the great political cartoonist for the Washington Post from 1929 to a year ago, who died. And they gave it to the New York Times, a newspaper that doesn't run political cartoons.
Yeah.
You know.
Nice of them, though.
Yeah. I guess it's the lack of thought that counts.
Maybe they're trying to encourage them for the future.
Our guest in studio is Mr. Ward Sutton. His comic strip is called Sutton Impact. And a little birdie told me that you got some other projects in mind, projects that will take you far, far away from our little metropolis. We're going to talk about that and a whole lot more with Ward Sutton and our very special guest co-host Ted Rawl when we come back here on Air America Radio.
You gotta keep them separated.
Hi, this is Reverend Barry Lynn from Americans United for Separation of Church and State, here to remind you that God and politics don't mix. That's why I get my God from the Good Book and my politics from Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
This is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. My name is Mark Riley with our guest co-host Ted Rawl and our special guest in studio, cartoonist Ward Sutton. Now, you are working on something outside the cartoon world, and you're going to be leaving town for a minute this summer?
I'm going to be going undercover in Red State America and living in beautiful North Dakota.
Well, now you've kind of torn the sheet off the undercover part.
Yeah. Well, it's a big state. You might have a hard time finding me. A lot of open space. But I'm actually going to be making an animated film, and the only way I could afford to do that was to sublet my New York apartment and live in the cheap wild of North Dakota.
So is it still available? You want to get off the email address?
Yeah, give me a call. No.
Oh, so you got a tenant? Because I could use a pied-à-terre here.
Yeah.
Now, you're financing this yourself?
Yeah, I'm going to make it all myself, too, using probably the Toon Boom program. I've been getting into animation for a while. Like I was saying earlier, you can't make much money off cartoons, as Ted knows.
So this is a cash grab.
This is not a cash grab, but I've been doing all sorts of things. I've basically made my living off of illustration, but I've also done things like rock posters, and I've done animation. I designed the animated opening to the TV show Strangers with Candy. It's kind of a cult hit.
Oh, my friend produced that show.
Yeah, that was
wow. I actually went out to their where they used to shoot it. There was a college in Rutherford, New Jersey.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've been out there a couple of times. It's a really whack show.
Yeah.
Wonderful, but still. I mean, Amy Sedaris is an acquired taste, but I really enjoy her work. So,
yeah.
You did that?
I got to play a cameo in an episode, too, and so that was
that's cool.
A special thrill. Yeah. But so I've been doing a lot of animation where I'm designing the animation, but I wanted to kind of combine the writing from my cartoons with the animation and actually make something. And I've done a few shorts like that, but this will be a bigger project.
This is a feature.
Well, I actually wrote a feature and decided I could never complete a feature in a year.
So. Yeah, it's incredible. Right. I mean, what's involved? Try to explain to the to people what exactly is involved. What you hear like, oh, so I'm animating a movie. What does that mean? What do you do?
Well, for me, it's not going to be like Toy Story where I'm dictating it by a computer program, but I am going to be drawing it by hand and then scanning it in and using this program Toon Boom to make all my drawings move.
So it like sort of uses vectors or?
Yeah, it's vector based drawings and.
Come on, no math words like vectors, all right?
Sorry, yeah.
Come on, I flunked
it. It's too early in the morning for vectors.
So what's the movie going to be about?
That remains to be seen.
Oh,
top secret.
He's invoking the fifth here.
Top secret.
I want to ask the two of you, because you're both cartoonists, you both push the envelope, you go out to the edge. Where is the line between satire and bad taste? Is that only when the different syndicates refuse to run it, or where do you draw the line?
Well, beauty and bad taste are in the eye of the beholder, I guess.
I think that's right. Yeah.
I did a cartoon in that's going to be in my book that's coming out that came out right after the shock and awe bombings of Iraq, and I had. Donald Rumsfeld, I'm not sure what I can say on the radio, but let's say pleasing himself, I guess
that's kind of, a good word.
As he's watching the footage on TV, and the caption was Donald Rumsfeld between press briefings, and there was a letter to the editor, which was exactly the response I wanted, where somebody was like disgusted by my cartoon, and the point that I wanted to raise with this cartoon is why would people out there be disgusted by masturbation and they're not disgusted by the killing of all these people through bombing? Mm. And I wanted to kind of force that issue out.
You were the agent provocateur.
Exactly.
Well, that's interesting because if you look at people, the prince of bad taste in film is John Waters. I think we can all kind of acknowledge that, at least in his early work. But now John Waters is no longer really seen as a purveyor of bad taste anymore. The guy is mainstream. Do you ever think that maybe someday people will look back at the work you're doing now and say, that it really wasn't bad taste, that in other words, people's tastes have changed to the extent that your work may be seen as more mainstream?
I think that inevitably happens with any kind of art form, and I was thinking about it at the Super Bowl where Paul McCartney is singing Get Back and some of the lyrics of that song, but it's all seen as this quaint family value song, whereas...
Culture changes.
Yeah.
Think of the stuff that got Lenny Bruce thrown into prison.
Yeah.
It's all tame now by comparison.
Yeah.
Culture shifts, and it's inevitable.
Well, yeah, I mean, you can hear a lot of that stuff that Lenny Bruce said on most... hip-hop records.
And the sad thing is, getting back to the war cartoon that you described, right? I mean, people are going to look back, I think, in 20 years and wonder what the hell they were thinking during the Bush years.
Yeah.
Even the people who went along with it. I mean, who now really justifies Nixon, who was in his, who voted for him in 72?
Yeah.
Yeah, people are busy apologizing for having voted for Nixon in 72. Some people are apologizing for having voted for Bush in 2000 and in 2004. What's next for you? After the animated feature spectacular.
Well, the book comes out in June, and I'm going to do a tour on the West Coast and also be here in New York for some special events around the release of the book.
What's the new book called?
Sutton Impact, The Cartoons of Ward Sutton.
From Seven Stories Press.
Exactly.
Right? Publication date is?
June 17th.
Excellent. Look for it in stores. Order it online. Get it from your website is Sutton Impact Sutton.com.
SuttonImpactStudio.com.
SuttonImpactStudio.com.
What, Sutton Impact wasn't available?
It was taken by some widgets company in Canada.
Oh, wow. Ward Sutton, thank you so much for being with us. We're hearing the facts. We've got the liberal agenda coming in from the Streisand compound, and here to deliver it, none other than Kent the Colonel Jones.
Good morning. Write these down. One, prepare for Easter. Make sure your children's Easter eggs are free range. Two, hemp Easter bonnet, tofu ham. Think about it. Three, eliminate Easter egg hunt because it discriminates against kids who are directionally challenged. Four, resist the urge to refer to Easter as the Christian co-opted pagan spring fertility festival. That's insensitive. Don't do that. Five, today's phrase, just dropping into conversation. It's Easter. Hey, that's great. I guess you're going to honor Jesus by doing something to help the poor and not just sit around in new clothes eating chocolate all day, right? Right? Wake up, sheepo. The bunny's stealing your soul.
Ooh, you're a rough guy, Colonel. Thanks a lot. Thank you, Ted Raw, for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thanks again to Ward Sutton.
Thank you.
And my thanks to our co-hosts all week long, Mick Foley, Laura Flanders, and Ellis Hennigan. Mark Maron returns on Monday. Happy Easter, everybody. This is Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Weather is